anything either stupid or careless, which is a bit unusual. I've got no story of athleticism or heroism either. I just got hurt. I still hurt every day of my life. But my pain isn't my point. My point is whenever pain is an uninvited guest, let's say cancer drops in, financial reversal happens, the specter of death hovers over your otherwise happy home, the why me question invariably becomes your constant companion. And if you're like me, you probably ask that question a lot. Bad stuff is really kind of random, like the school shooting in Kentucky. Most were spared, 20 were not. The latest randomness. There were others this week. There was a school bus of frightened kids that slid down an icy street in Massachusetts. There were the Olympic gymnasts sexually assaulted by their team physician. Storm chaser Joel Taylor died unexpectedly at age 38. And that's just this week. Oh, and I almost forgot. Add to that list the 12 camels who were unfairly disqualified from a Saudi Arabia beauty contest because they used Botox. That's true. Google it. Not now. It is sad but true. Life is hard. It's not fair either. As a pastor, I spent a lot of my time counseling good people who've endured some pretty bad stuff. And invariably, every follower wants to know, how come God let this happen? Have you ever asked that question? Ever felt like maybe God dealt you a rotten hand? And because of the treatment you endured or an experience that didn't go the way you planned, you look around and you see people far less faithful, far less generous, far less committed to kingdom objectives, and yet they're tiptoeing through the tulips. Have you ever thought, that's not fair? Well, I've taken the answers that I've heard to the why me question, and I've boiled them all down to what I see as four basic answers. All of them are wrong, but they're answers, okay? Here's the first wrong answer. Well, this pain proves there is no God because this pain makes no sense. I don't like how my life is going, so count me out, God. That's what Job's wife told her husband to do, just curse God and die. But see, the problem of senseless suffering doesn't go away just because you thumb your nose at God. I agree with Martin Luther King when he said that if there is no divine law, how can we ever know human law versus what is just or what is unjust? In other words, you take God out of the equation, and even though there is no more outrage because something awful has happened, the reality is, hey, dude, the strong eat the weak, it's life, get over it. In other words, if there is no God, all values are arbitrary. All definitions of justice are either the result of my training or my temperament, period. All that to say, abandoning your beliefs in God simply because you can't explain why this thing has happened to you, it really improves nothing about your life at all. If anything, it removes the necessary resources to face bad stuff that is still going to come your way. Here's the second wrong answer. Life isn't fair, and not even God can help me. Because senseless suffering proves it, God isn't in control. Have you ever heard that? I mean, not even God could stop that. That's what Rabbi Harold Kushner decided in his classic book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. In it, he concludes that, yes, life is unfair, but take comfort in knowing God is just as frustrated as you are. After watching his son die a horrible death, Kushner concluded that even God has a hard time keeping chaos in check because, and this is his conclusion, not mine, God is a God of justice, but not a God of power. Therefore, he's just as frustrated, just as flummoxed by the unfairness of life as you are. But like you, he lacks the power to change that. Here's my question, though, for the good rabbi. If God is such a wimp, why doesn't he just resign and let a real God take over? Third wrong answer. No, life isn't fair, but it could be fair if you would get your act together. See, God spares some. He allows pain to happen to others because he tends to reward good people. Have you ever heard that? So, baby, I got an inside track. And we hear that drivel constantly from those especially who promise health and prosperity, as long as you ask for health and prosperity in faith. Have you heard that? Just name it, claim it, and baby, you can frame it, which would be awesome, if not for the Bible. See, the Bible strongly suggests that people who suffer more the Bible strongly suggests that people who suffer more are worse than people who don't. You see, that was the self-righteous conclusions that Job's buddies had. Remember, they sat around consoling him. He was going through one bad thing after another. And this was their advice. Well, all this bad stuff is happening because, see, we're living right, Job, and you're not. By the end of the book, God unleashes his fury on those jerks, men that Job called miserable comforters. And they still exist, don't they? Catherine Lenskug, a scholar of all things C.S. Lewis, was a strong believer who suffered from MS until she died in 2003. Soon after her diagnosis, a relative, one given to prosperity thinking, said, "You must like being sick. You bring so much of it on yourself." Well, thank you. Another so-called friend said, "Catherine, if your faith is real, tell everybody right now that God has healed you." Even her pastor, after having watched her hobble about the church, said, "You fake that limp just to get attention." Really? Folks, this world is way too fallen and far too broken to have this neat little package of good people getting good lives and bad people getting bad lives. Fourth wrong answer. God knows what he's doing, so shut up and trust him. Now, that answer is partly correct, because God does know what he's doing, right? But it's inadequate because God gives us more to go on than just that. God didn't just create a world marked by death and evil. In fact, there was no evil at all. But when humanity turned aside and away from God, things changed. We were put here to live wholly for him, but instead we began living for ourselves, and that's when death and decay and disease came into our world. But even then, God didn't abandon us. Instead, he came in the person of Jesus, subjected himself to suffering on the cross, so that one day, I hope it's soon, he's going to come back to earth and end all suffering, but not have to end us in the process. So, yeah, God knows exactly what he's doing, but he can't explain it to us, primarily because our thimble-sized brains can't contain it. Remember what Paul said? Who has known the mind of the Lord? And the answer is, not me. To think that my little pea-sized brain could make even the tiniest splash in the vastness that is God's wide ocean? No. Our perspective is too limited. We only see what's in front of me right now, but God sees past, present, and future in panorama. What we see is pain, he sees as progress. What we call adversity, he knows it's really advancement. What we think is making my life miserable, he's actually bringing it to us to bring ultimate meaning. So whatever else that means, it definitely means this. Although I cannot grasp why it is that God allows these things in my life and why at times it feels so very random, at least I can know this. Bad stuff isn't at all what I thought it would be. Because it doesn't mean God doesn't love me. It doesn't mean that he doesn't care for me. No, he's so committed to my happiness, he willingly subjected himself to the most intense of suffering on Calvary, and he did it for me just as he did it for you. And even now, Peter, in this letter that we're reading, seems to suggest that Jesus, right now, he has his eyes fixed on you, no matter what it is you're going through. Do you see it? For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. You think God isn't involved in your life, has no clue what you're going through? His eyes are on you. His ears are listening for every prayer you pray. There's not a moment when God isn't guarding you. In fact, I love the way Isaiah put it. God has engraved you on the palms of his hands. Your walls, your suffering, your pain, your loss, they are ever before him. Well, if that's true, Pastor, why doesn't he do something? Is it because Kushner's right that God's anemic and can't help me? No. He knows what you're facing. And yes, he cares. And even more, he is able. It's just he's also inscrutable. And what that means is he's got a perfect plan for your life, but it extends so far beyond your ability to contain it, he can't explain it. God's going to finish his perfect work. But we kind of look at our world, and then we look around and go, you know, that doofus over there, he's a jerk. Yet everything's coming up roses for him. There's nothing fair about that, and I get that. Sometimes it does seem that those who do bad still get nothing but good. Have you noticed? Just know this. His eyes are on the righteous. His face is against those who do evil. In other words, he's faithful. He will do as he promised. He will not let the guilty go unpunished. And in his good time, every injustice will be made right. I love the words of Longfellow. He said, though the mills of God grind slowly, they grind exceedingly small. Paul agreed, saying, do not be deceived. Our God cannot be mocked. A man will reap what he sows. Now, that doesn't mean, nor does God ever suggest, that since that's true, you need to just shut up and trust him. No, God is faithful to give us truth to help us stand up under it. And I want to give you some of that truth right now. Here's the first one. Usually, bad stuff doesn't happen to good people. Peter says, who's going to harm you if you are eager to do good? And the implied answer is no one. Because if you're eager to do good, if you're faithful with what God has given you, if you're a lover of the truth and your passion is to do what is right and good, for the most part, your life is going to be good. You pay your debts, use credit responsibly, give to the Lord his portion, and he's going to give back to you in even greater measure, which means you're far less likely to get in financial weeds. If you eat right, get lots of exercise and rest, you'll probably be in better health than people who don't do those things. Drive the speed limit, obey traffic laws, you're less likely to become a statistic. Help people who are in need. Serve those who are hurting. Chances are someone's going to help you when you're the one who's hurting. Now, the key to this truth is usually. Live a clean, honest life, and usually, for the most part, typically, more often than not, you're going to suffer less. Now, here's the problem with that. Even though it's true that way more good stuff happens in your life than bad stuff, which stuff gets all the coverage? Bad. But, I mean, come on. Most people wake up most days feeling mostly pretty good. Am I right? Most illnesses get better. Most airplanes land safely. Most children get to and from school without either sliding or shootings. And most people who want a job have a job. It's the freak accident that's unusual. The terrorist at a mall, a spouse with cancer, These are the exceptions, not the rule. But because they carry such catastrophic and life-shattering implications, these unusual events tend to loom larger than life, especially for those who live with them and have to move forward in life in spite of them. And because these heartaches are so in your face, when that's where you're living, when you have to endure some epic tragedy, you tend not to see anything else but that tragedy, right? Because nothing else matters but the radical removal of every last vestige of whatever that bad stuff might be. And when it's not removed, we stomp our feet, we shake our fist, and we say, life's not fair. And that's okay if you want to say that. Just understand, usually it is. It's just sometimes, even when you eat right, do good, try to live right, sometimes things go wrong. It's not the norm, but it happens. Here's the second truth I want you to understand. Occasionally, bad stuff does happen to good people. I say occasionally because in verse 14, Peter says, but even if you should suffer. Now, I want to explain that little word, if. In the Greek, that pesky little two-letter word, depending on the grammatical construction, can mean one of four different things. It can be written as a first-class condition, meaning that statement is true, if you should suffer, and you will. It can also be a second-class condition, assuming the negative, if you should suffer, but you won't. Or a third-class condition, which is how we use if, in that it could be true, but it might not be true, if you should suffer, and you might. But verse 14 is written as a fourth-class condition, meaning it does happen, but it's rare. It's unlikely, but it is possible. It's rare, but don't be shocked if suffering comes a knocking at your door, because occasionally bad stuff does happen to good people. So here's the big question of the day. What do you do when it does? How do you respond when you are called to suffer for what is right? Well, far from just saying shut up, Peter gives us five bits of helpful advice. And to help you remember them, I've put them in ABC format. Are you ready for this? Oh, good. Three of us. Here's letter A. Peter says, on that rare occasion when bad stuff happens, always view that trial as a blessing. Because even if you should suffer for what is right, here's the payoff. You are blessed. And not just blessed. The construction means blessed over and over and over again. So there's a happiness because you're suffering. Ain't that a kick? But it's not just Peter. James said it too. He said, consider it pure joy when you face trials. Paul also said, rejoice in your sufferings. We read that stuff and go, seriously? Why would any normal person want to do that? Well, one good reason is what Peter says. If you suffer for doing good and endure it, this is commendable before God. And why is it commendable? Because to this you were called. Because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. In other words, trials don't happen often, but when they do, don't let them throw you. Because to this you were called. Just as Christ was called to suffer, you are also called to suffer. And though we resist suffering with every fiber of our being, Peter's saying, dude, that's the road you're supposed to be on, just like Jesus. Somebody said, if I realize that a certain destination to which I want to go will include some bumpy roads, then every jolt along the way reminds me I'm on the right road. And that's why Paul says, rejoice, because this trial you're facing is God's loving reminder, dude, you're on the right path. keep going, you're doing a good work. Yeah, there's going to be some dark valleys and deep depressions and vast chasms. But rejoice, not that you're hurting, but that the hurt is telling you you're going the right direction. God is at work. He's accomplishing His perfect work in your life. And that's why Jesus said, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Yee-haw! Rejoice. He didn't say that part. But rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. How can I find peace in the midst of my pain when I remember someday this is going to all be rewarded? Maybe it won't happen till eternity. I had a guy just tell me he's been waiting 7 years. It might not happen till eternity, but God has reserved for me, for you, for everyone who has known bad stuff, His perfect reward. Well, after the letter A comes the letter... Didn't sound very confident there. So always view your trial as a blessing, but also be courageous. See the verse? Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. Kind of sounds like Peter's repeating himself, but those are actually two different Greek terms. What he's saying is don't be seized by terror and don't be worried either. In other words, don't panic, because God is on your side, which was especially comforting to this crowd because their suffering was externally generated. What I mean by that is they had been forced from their homes in Jerusalem just because they followed Jesus, and they were now living in a strange land where nobody, I mean nobody, liked them. So every day they were harassed because of what they believed and tempted to compromise their morals, plus the daily trial of trying to keep their purity in the face of the ridicule of their peers. In other words, they lived a lot like you. So like you, they were tempted to be afraid. Yet Peter said, don't go there. And Paul said, always remember, if God is for you, who can be against you? And Jesus said, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, but cannot touch your soul. So relax. After all, who's going to truly harm you if you're doing good? So do good. And more often than not, good is going to be done to you. I love how David put it. I was young and now I'm old, yet I've never seen the righteous forsaken nor their children begging bread. Because God always provides if you're courageous and if you do not give way to panic. So even when life is bad, God can make life into something very, very good. That's the point. After B comes, oh, much better. But in your hearts, set apart, or for our purposes, confess Christ as Lord. Now, that means more than just receiving Him as your Savior. It means releasing to Him ultimate control, in that you acknowledge that He has the right to do both in you and to you whatever He thinks best. That's a tough assignment under the best of circumstances, right? But it's especially hard when God's best feels very, very wrong. This week, Chris and I were talking with some friends. The topic of pain came up, even more to the point, my pain. And I was trying to explain that my life's goal has been in my later years to embrace whatever story God wanted to write through me, wherever that story would take me, and that this current pain was just another one of my story's chapters. And I heard my friend mumble under her breath, your life sure has a lot of chapters. I didn't respond to that, although her comment got me thinking about another believer who's now with Jesus, who also knew substantial pain. I want to tell her story. Her name is Elizabeth Elliot. She was a missionary and a wonderful writer. And her most fascinating book to me, one that's out of print, very hard to find, but I nabbed a copy not long ago on Amazon. It's a fictional novel about a linguist who gave up marriage, career, and family. She moved to the rainforest of South Africa to use her linguistic skills to translate the Bible into the dialect of a remote Indian tribe. Their language had never been written down. It was an oral language only, but she wanted to write it down so they could have their own Bible. So she went into the country and found the one man who knew all three necessary languages, the region's Indian language, that tribe's remote oral language, and Spanish. He's probably the only person on the planet who could help her do what she felt called by God to do. And so since her ministry hinged on this one man, she moved out to the jungle where he and his family lived, and they went to work for months and then years, making great progress, except you're near the end of the book, and the missionary, the woman, actually kills her partner, the man that who knew the languages. See, he got sick, so she gave him some penicillin, but he died because the penicillin was bad. The whole tribe turned on her, and in fact, they took all of her little note cards and a file cabinet full of Bible verses that they had already translated, and they tore it all up and threw it in the river. So that literally everything about this woman's life was gone. Everything taken and down the drain. Nothing was as she thought it was going to be. And then the novel ends. Everything falls apart. The end. And you're near the end of the book, and you know there's only a few pages, and you're thinking, God, you're going to have to come through fast. And you turn the last page or so, and you go, oh, this is going to be great, God, except it's over. Except for the words of the missionary. Listen to this. Now in the clear light of day, I see that God, if he was merely my accomplice, we might say assistant, he had betrayed me. If, on the other hand, he was God, he had freed me. I find that I can no longer arrange my life in an orderly succession of projects with realizable goals and demonstrable effects. I cannot designate this activity as useful and that one as useless, for often the categories are reversed, and even more often, I'm at a loss to apply either label. For the work in the end, as well as the labeling, is God's. That this missionary woman had come to see God as her assistant. So he was eventually going to come through for her. She'd pray and do good things, and God wouldn't edit her. She would edit him. He would never reshape her. She would reshape him. Now, if you have that kind of view of your God, if you see him as a means to get to your end, trust me, friend, life is going to run aground against the hard rocks of reality. And the result will be disaster. And in fact, when this book came out, that's how the Christian world responded. They hated Elizabeth's book. In fact, one seminary president banned it from the school bookstore and called it a travesty. She got all kind of hate mail, people saying, oh, I could never believe in a God like that, or God would never do something that awful to somebody as wonderful as a missionary. But Elizabeth just laughed. Here's why. Because although some of the details were altered, that fictional novel was the story of her life. And what she had discovered, Elizabeth, in the midst of her own inexplicable pain, is that our God is not a God of happy endings. He is His own happy ending. So if I have Him, how could I ever think that by adding anything to Him is going to give me an even happier ending? That's deep. Because I can't. If God is just my accomplice, then pain is His betrayal of me. But if He is God, my pain can free me. Have you found the freedom in knowing that if you serve God simply because you have God, that everything else you get in this life is gravy? You see, when you shake your fist at God and demand only what is good and never what is bad, here's what you're doing. You are serving a lesser God and yet expecting the one true God to save you, even as you use Him to get to the God you really want Him to be. And Jesus is standing on the sidelines going, "What am I, chopped liver? I mean, I'm supposed to be up here in heaven sorry that all you get is me? Is that it? All we can hope for is just Jesus?" Let me tell you about just Jesus. Just Jesus, whose rule and peace will never end, upholding us with justice and righteousness forever. Just Jesus. Just Jesus, whose resurrection assures us that He is and forever will be, making all things new. Who can fulfill our deepest longings and who will give us our sought after and eternally happy ending. Just Jesus, who can make everything sad come unglued. Have you ever experienced that? Just Jesus, who promises that every chapter in your story will be better than the chapter before. Just Jesus, who can give you the soaring strength of a mighty eagle. Just Jesus, whose name is above every name and at whose name every knee will bow. And who's going to give us a new name too, a name that is going to endure forever and ever and ever. Just Jesus. After absorbing all of that criticism, and my God would never let something like that happen, although it had happened to Elizabeth, and knowing from her own experience that just Jesus is always way more than enough, listen to what Elizabeth wrote to her critics. "If I dethrone Him and demand that He act in ways that satisfy my ideas, He is God in my pocket. But God is God, and Jesus is Lord." So if we just stop trying to make God in our likeness, maybe He could start making us into His. If we could just let God stretch our imaginations instead of confining Him to our imaginations, then God could be freed with a freedom that is far beyond our wildest imaginations. And that's what Elizabeth actually did with her life. And what Peter is urging us to do with ours, to confess, that is, to set apart me and acknowledge that just Jesus is more than enough and the happiest ending I could ever hope for. He's not my assistant, He's Lord. And yet, until you confess Jesus as Lord over all, the God you serve is way too small. And that's why you just can't find peace. So tell Him. Tell Him who you believe Him to be. And release into His hands your pain. And say, "Lord, I belong to You, not the other way around. I am Yours. So, Lord, use me according to Your will. My heart is in Your hands. You do Your divine pleasure for my life and my trust and my all. It is firmly fixed in You." But when you do that, just like Elizabeth did, listen to me, you better be prepared to explain yourself. Because trust me, if you're under attack, if you're going through a rough patch, you're dealing with some teeth-shattering setback, and you handle that crisis with courage and a mindset that sets apart Jesus as Lord and not your personal assistant, people are going to see you and they're going to want to know, how'd she do that? Have you ever endured such incredible loss or pain with enough joy that people do that? They kind of look at you. Maybe they never ask you directly, but they ask somebody else. How does she keep doing that? How's he still believing in God's favor and living with unflagging obedience? If it was me, I'd have checked out long ago. How come she didn't? Peter says, well, since that line of questioning is going to happen in advance, why don't you have an answer? Do you see it? In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord, and always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you, to give the reason for the hope you have, and do it with gentleness and respect. When I said this last service, it got quieter than the whole message. So I come into this with fear and trembling because you mentioned this name, and man, people just pick sides. Remember when President Trump, that's the part, okay, Grace, umbrella, all right? Remember when he said John McCain wasn't a war hero? You remember him saying that? He said he's only a war hero because he got captured. I like people who aren't captured. You remember he said that? Insensitive at best, right? But not unlike the way President Kennedy answered those who asked him how he became a war hero. He said it was involuntary. They sank my boat. The point is, heroes are made because affliction brings opportunity. And in the case of the believer, it's the opportunity for us to give an answer for why we have hope. Peter's point is, be ready when that moment happens. Don't wait till you're asked to get ready. Think it through now so that when some curious onlooker wants to know why you're still hanging tough, instead of just saying, oh, I owe it all to Jesus. No, Peter says, make sure your answer is an apologia, which means explanation. This is your defense. Your logical, thought-through plea for why you're still living by faith in spite of what has happened. He's not saying be so ready that you're rehearsed, because a good testimony always comes from the heart. It's never polished or over-prepared. Yet, think it through. Be ready, because if you're doing it right, people are going to want to know how they do it. One of my favorite preachers, Steve Brown, used to say that he believed that one reason Christians face affliction is because for every unbeliever that gets cancer, God sees to it that a Christian also gets cancer so that the watching world can see the difference in how we respond. Okay, I don't know if you can make that walk on all fours, but here's what I do know about that. Your suffering could provide for you the greatest testimony of your life. So having earned the right to be hurt because of how you respond by faith, Peter says, make the most of the moment. Have an answer ready. Give a powerful defense. But when you do speak about what it is you've been through or are going through, be gentle, be respectful, don't be cocky. Stay meek. Be humble. Finally, he says, exhibit a clear conscience. That's the letter E. Keeping a clear conscience so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. When times get tough, and for everybody they will sometime, when you face less than ideal circumstance, Your greatest asset is never the reality of your circumstance as much as it is the clarity of your conscience. Let me explain what I mean by that. It means, first of all, keep a clear conscience so that you don't give your detractors ammunition. See, this whole chapter is about suffering because of what you believe. This betrayal, this attack against these folks is because of their faith. And so Peter says, keep a clear conscience by not returning fire with fire. Don't be obnoxious. Don't be superior. Don't lie. Don't accuse. Don't hurt somebody just because they've hurt you. Keep your conscience clear. Second, it also means don't make excuses for bad behavior. Instead, just keep obeying God. See, one of the great destroyers when it comes to whatever you're going through right now, your suffering. This is something everybody's got to work on, but this is the thing that can destroy your testimony. Self-pity. Because self-pity is how we console ourselves, often to the point that we think we can do whatever we want to do because, well, I deserve it. See that thing? Years ago, I had a friend who went through a devastating financial reversal. And it destroyed his heart so thoroughly, my friend went out and had an affair. He'd always been strongly moral, but in the vortex of his suffering, he said, you know, after what I've been through, I deserve this. That's self-pity. I'm hurting, so I'm going to do this. The problem is his self-indulgent behavior just made things worse because not only did his career tank, his marriage followed, which compounded his financial problems. Man, you got to love the authenticity of Scripture. Dude, if you're suffering, Peter says, don't just keep a stiff upper lip. That's not the answer. Yell if you gotta. Put your face in a pillow and scream. Bite the rug if you gotta. Cry out to the heavens with no filter at all if that's what gets you through. Just maintain your discipline. And don't decide that because you did A, yet God didn't do B, X is what you plan to do now, come hell or high water. No. Cry if you gotta, but keep your conscience clean. That's what Job did. He tore his robe, he shaved his head in full life ain't fair mode. But then he fell to the ground in worship and he said, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. And what does the Bible say next? In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Just saying, it doesn't typically go that way. What typically happens is when life goes bad, we start doing stuff kind of as a self-medication. We think if we do this, it will numb my heart. It will console my spirit, even if it does betray my conscience. Or we do keep that stiff upper lip and we drill down on self-discipline to such a degree nobody can relate to us anymore. Not Job. He screamed. He cried out in agony. But he never, ever, ever walked away from his God. One of my all-time favorite verses, a life's verse, is Isaiah 40:31. It says, but they who wait on the Lord will renew their strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not be weary. They will walk and not faint. And the reason I love that verse, just keep looking at it for a moment, is because Isaiah speaks to three stages in every life. And sometimes, like it or not, you're going to be in every one of those stages. First, he talks about mounting up like an eagle. Because some days you're flying, right? Life is good and God is great. I'm on top of the world. But then there are other days. I'm still making progress. Running. Trying really hard not to become weary as I run. Keep doing the routine. Going through my progressions. But mostly just trying hard not to throw in the towel.
then there are other times.
All I can do is try to walk without fainting.
Have you ever been there?
You're moving, just barely. When Peter says keep a clear conscience, he's not saying don't have an affair, although don't have an affair. But it's okay if you gotta weep. It's also okay if one day you're flying and the next you feel like you're barely walking. The point is, keep walking. Because what happens is far too many of us stop precisely because we don't like what God is putting us through, and so we stop doing what believers are always supposed to do. I plead with you, don't stop. Now, don't become a stoic either. You've got tears, cry them. God gave them to us. He means for them to be expressed. But even in your tears, keep your conscience clean. One final truth. First truth, usually bad stuff doesn't happen. Second truth, occasionally it does happen. But even when it does, truth number three, bad really can be good, especially if you've been good. Peter says, it is better if it is God's will to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. And why is it better? Because sometimes, he says, it's just God's will. Can't explain it. Sometimes it's just God's perfect will for you to endure heartache. But as you do, make certain you're not suffering just because you're an idiot. You know what I'm saying? Or a hypocrite. But that as you suffer well, keep your eyes on Him. And that suffering in itself, Peter says, it can be your greatest blessing. Besides, there's another promise from God, one we don't like hearing, but that doesn't mean it's not true. Let me read it for you. All things, including your thing, my friend, all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to His purpose. You believe that? Yeah, you may have to wait a while for the good to be revealed, but God has promised, and I'm telling you, it will happen. It will. One other thing, and I'm done. The glory of God is if you are hurting, God not only knows, He cares. And He cares so much, in fact, I want you to know that God counts every tear that is ever washed across your face. Did you know that? Where does it say that? It's in Psalm 56. It's from the pen of David, who knew something about suffering. He said to the Lord, You've kept track of my every toss and turn through every sleepless night. Each tear has been entered in your ledger, every ache written in your book. The New Living Translation says, You have collected all my tears in your bottle. Let me explain that to you. That's a throwback to ancient Middle Eastern culture. And when a soldier would go out to battle, he'd get a tear vial and he would give it to either his mother or his wife. And she would promise that while he was away, she would cry for him. And every night she would catch her tears and keep them in that vial. So that when he returned, if he did, he would know just how much he meant to her. Well, that's what God is telling you from His heaven. I am numbering your every tear, my child, every ache, every wound, every pain. And when your life is over, I promise I'll be at the gate. I'm going to meet you right up here in my heaven with a bottle. Maybe for some of you it'll be a bucket. But when you arrive, you will know He never missed, not even one. It's the quantum physics of our great God. One broken heart always breaks his heart in two. And so I'm here to tell you, when you cry, you never cry alone. And God will. He promised he would. He will catch your every falling tear because he is always there to keep you and me from falling apart. Let's pray. Oh, Lord, I don't know who this is for today. Maybe just me. But I think not. In fact, I know some of the stories in this room. And I felt my own tears welling in my eyes and my own struggle to hold them back, knowing the stories of people that I love and knowing how imperfect and impure I am and how great you are. I know your tears are even greater, for you know far more than we could ever hope to know. God, I just ask that in this quiet time as we close this service, that every man, woman, and young person in this room right now would bring their greatest heartache, their suffering, their pain to the foot of the cross. And know that they find in you, they will find there, the hope they need, the strength to carry on. I pray for those who are flying today, and God, I'm thankful for them. And I pray that you keep that flying story happening just as long as it is profitable for them spiritually. And I pray also for those who are running. They're getting a little tired, maybe even a tad gimpy, but they're running. But I pray most of all today for those who are just trying not to faint. Fix their eyes, Lord, on you, the author, the finisher of our faith. May they find in you the joy they need to carry on. And Lord, as we meet around your table now, help us remember what you have called us into. At least you weren't hypocritical about it, because you yourself endured the most heinous suffering this world has ever known. So that as we follow in the footsteps of Jesus and experience pain as he experienced pain, we know that his footsteps will lead us to wherever you are. And we thank you for that. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And together we all pray. Amen.